So do you all have 17?
Yes.
Okay, I'll wait. So are you enjoying this Majjhima Nikaya?
Yes.
Do you think it's starting to give you a little deeper sense of the Buddhist way of viewing things, or no?
With your explanations.
Okay.
Without it.
Yeah. I mean, I've read this text more than once, and some of the times when I was reading it, I read it when I was in Thailand. I spent quite a lot of time there without anybody who spoke English. I often was in that state, and not necessarily on retreat anywhere. So, and there was a library at the monastery I spent most of my time at, and they had the whole Tipitaka that had been translated into English. So I didn't have this translation. This is a beautiful translation. But I spent a lot of time, I would take a sutra and then meditate on it and work with it for like a few days, and then I'd take the next one and so forth. So that was the most rich time I spent. And then my beloved teacher, Namgyal Rinpoche, at one time said, if you really want to understand Buddhism, you should just read just this text, the 152 different classes on the Middle Lake Sayings of Buddhism. And he said it basically covers pretty well, you know, the whole lay of how Buddhism approaches practice and cosmology and things like that. I think that's pretty accurate. I mean, there are things in here that are covered differently in the Abhidhamma and stuff like that, but for a general, really good grounding, this book is really wonderful. Which is, of course, why I suggested that we work with it. So thus have I heard. Does somebody else want to read tonight? There's a deafening silence.
There's a nerve over there.
You want to read?
I can read.
Okay. And I may interrupt you here or there.
That's fine.
And if you want to check footnotes, I think it's always good to read the footnotes.
Okay.
So, okay, go ahead.
Just you'll have to help me with some of the pronunciations.
Sure.
Okay. Thus I have heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jetta's Grove. And at the Pidetta's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, venerable sir, they replied, the Blessed One said this. Bhikkhus, I shall teach you a discourse on jungle thickets. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, venerable sir, the bhikkhus replied. The Blessed One said this. Hear, bhikkhus. A bhikkhu lives in the jungle thicket.
And there's a footnote
there.
Let's check at 223.
I need a book. Someone has to read that.
Yeah, I'll read it. The pattern on which this verse, right through 3 to 6, verses 3 to 6, there's a pattern on which they're constructed. And the pattern is, in the first time, this first one, number 3, verse 3, which is what you started, it says, there is no progress made in the meditation, and no requisites are supplied. The second verse is, no progress is made in one's practice, and requisites are plentiful. The third one is, progress and requisites are scarce, not a lot, but there are some. And the fourth one is progress and requisites are plentiful. And so if it's no progress but requisites are scarce, requisites, there's four requisites for someone who is an ordained or a monk or a bhikkhu, and their food, clothing, shelter, and medicine. That's the requisites. Okay? So, if no progress and requisites are scarce, then you should leave. No progress and requisites are plentiful, then you should leave. Progress and requisites are both scarce, stay. Progress and requisites are plentiful, stay. So that's basically what he's saying, because there's a lot of question about, you know, well, some people, they would go and meditate for a long time out in the woods where there was like very little requisite, or they would go because, you know, sometimes people feel like they have to be holy. You know what I mean? So that they think that if you really go through terrible times, you should be making progress, but their concentration isn't developing because it's too difficult. So he's giving all of the monks an idea of how to pick a place to do a retreat. And first of all, he starts with a jungle thicket, then he goes through towns, villages, towns, monasteries, and so forth. But basically, that's the formula. Okay? Is that good? So carry on.
While he's living there, in his unestablished mindfulness.
Is there an inn there?
Oh, while he is living there, his unestablished mindfulness does not become established.
Right.
His unconcentrated mind does not become concentrated.
Right.
His undestroyed taints do not come to destruction. He does not attain the unattained supreme security from bondage, and also the requisites of life that should be obtained by one gone forth, robe, alms, food, resting place, and medicinal requisites are hard to come by. The bhikkhu,
that's not a footnote, so just keep going.
Consider thus, I am living in this jungle thicket. While I am living here, my unestablished mindfulness does not become established. I do not attain the unattained supreme security from bondage, and also the requisites of life are hard to come by. That bhikkhu should depart from that jungle thicket that very night or that very day. He should not continue living there. Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu lives in some jungle thicket. While he is living there, his unestablished mindfulness does not become established. His unconcentrated mind does not become concentrated. His undestroyed taints do not come to destruction. He does not attain the unattained supreme security from bondage. Yet, the requisites of life that should be obtained by one gone forth are easy to come by. The bhikkhu should consider thus, I am living in this jungle thicket. While I am living here, my unestablished mindfulness does not become established. I do not attain the unattained supreme security from bondage. Yet the requisites of life that should be obtained by one gone forth are easy to come by. Therefore,
however,
I do not go forth from the home life into homelessness for the sake of robes, alms, food, resting place, and medicinal requisites. Moreover, while I am living here, my unestablished mindfulness does not become established. I do not attain the unattained supreme security from bondage. Having reflected thus, that bhikkhu should depart from that jungle thicket. He should not continue living there. Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu lives in some jungle thicket. While he is living there, his unestablished mindfulness becomes established. His unconcentrated mind becomes concentrated. His undestroyed taint comes to destruction. He attains the unattained supreme security from bondage. Yet the requisites of life that should be obtained by one gone forth are hard to come by. The bhikkhu should consider thus, I am living in this jungle thicket. While I am living here, my unestablished mindfulness has become established. I have attained the unattained supreme security from bondage. Yet the requisites of life are hard to come by. However, I did not go forth from the home life into homelessness for the sake of robe, alms, food, resting place, and medicinal requisites. Moreover, while I am living here, my unestablished mindfulness has become established. I have attained the unattained supreme security from bondage. Having reflected thus, that bhikkhu should continue living in that jungle thicket. He should not depart. Here, bhikkhus. A bhikkhu lives in some jungle thicket. While he is living there, his unestablished mindfulness becomes established. His unconcentrated mind becomes concentrated. His undestroyed taints come to destruction. He attains the unattained supreme security from bondage. And also the requisites of life that should be obtained by one gone forth, robes, alms, food, resting place, and medicinal requisites are easy to come by. The bhikkhu should consider thus, I am living in this jungle thicket. While I am living here, my unestablished mindfulness has become established. I have attained the unattained supreme security from bondage, and also the requisites of life are easy to come by. That bhikkhu should continue living in that jungle thicket as long as life lasts. He should not depart.
So you notice the difference in the last line of that verse and the last line of the other verse? What's the last line of the previous verse? Having reflected thus, that bhikkhu should continue living in that jungle thicket, he should not depart. In the verse we just read, that bhikkhu should continue living in that jungle thicket as long as life lasts. So the first one is not saying he should stay there regardless of how sick he gets, if he needs medicine or anything. Do you understand? Mm-hmm. But this last one is saying, hey, this is it. This is good. But the one before is not suggesting. Not, it's like a very fine line, isn't it? So then the next one, carry on.
Number 18.
The next one is here, bhikkhus 7 to 10.
Oh, hold on. Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu lives independent upon a certain village.
And then it just carries on with the same four, the footnote basically says. In the certain village, his mind does not become concentrated, etc., etc. And neither are requisites easy to come by. In the second one, his mindfulness does not become established, etc., but requisites are easy to come by. In the third one, his mind is unestablished, mindfulness becomes established, but requisites are difficult to come by. In the last one, both are present. So the next four verses to say repeat the same thing as the thicket. But now he's in a village. So what the Buddha is basically doing is going through the different types of environments that you can live in and how you can tell a good environment. And you notice he's not saying anything about the thicket or about the village.
He's talking about the environment.
No, he's not. He's talking about your own progress and whether you have enough food.
Mm-hmm.
the unestablished mindfulness has not become established. That's not the environment, that's the inner. So then the next series, 11 to 14.
Here are the bhikkhus. A bhikkhu lives independent upon a certain town.
So, and again, the same four cases are gone through. And then the next one?
Here, bhikkhus. A bhikkhu lives independent upon a certain city.
And again, the same four. And then next?
Here, bhikkhus. A bhikkhu lives independent upon a certain country.
Right. And then the next one?
Here, bhikkhus. A bhikkhu lives independent upon a certain person. That very night or that very day.
That bhikkhu should depart from that person. Isn't that what it says? If there is neither concentration, it would be same as three there. If there is neither concentration established, etc., etc., nor is there the requisites, that bhikkhu should depart from that person without taking leave. Without taking leave, just go. That very... What is it? He should not continue following him. He should just leave. And then the next one?
Here, bhikkhus. A bhikkhu lives independent upon a certain person.
And then the fourth. Fourth one. Fourth verse. Going back to the fourth verse. His mindfulness does not become established, etc. But the requisites are present. So he gets all the four requisites, but his practice is not deepening. So what does it say he should do with that?
Having reflected thus that bhikkhu should depart from that person after taking leave, he should not continue following him.
So you actually check and see, well, wait a minute, is my actual progress, what I'm really interested in, is it happening here? Or not. And then leave.
But this time, you say goodbye.
Yep, this time he says goodbye, exactly.
Here, bhikkhus. A bhikkhu.
Actually. 225.
Yeah. Lives independent upon a
okay.
person. And then you follow with verse 5.
Which is so that there is concentration and there are barely enough of the requisites.
Having reflected thus, that he should continue following that person, he should not depart from him. Dear bhikkhu, a bhikkhu lives in dependence upon a certain person, and then 6, where you have
both the support and the concentration, etc.
That bhikkhu should continue following that person as long as life lasts. He should not depart from him, even if told to go away.
Interesting, huh? That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So now if you look at this a little deeper, we're starting to get now in the sutras, as you can see there is a slight progression with the sutras in this book. We're starting to get now in the sutras where you're not so much dependent on objects. The first stage of the teaching is generally speaking, you see an object and you meditate with some sense of making yourself in a good relationship with that object, whether it's the robes, whether it's the teaching, whether it's understanding, but it's outside of you. So that there is an identification rather than just going through life without what we would call you have no goal or you have a goal, right? So the first level of meditation is that you have a goal in a certain way, but it's an outer goal. The second level of practice is that you start looking at the motives that arise with certain goals, and you start choosing which motives are more wholesome. So you're less concerned with the goal than you are with the energy and how you're directing your life in terms of the outer. It's like the focus goes more toward motivation. And this is more about that. It's saying if your inner work is actually, your motives are more calm abiding. Concentration is the same as calm abiding, basically. If you are developing a greater sense of the ability to calmly abide regardless of circumstance, that's a good place. So what this sutra is pointing out to the people who are practicing all the time is that it is not so dependent on the outer. And this is very applicable today or any time that any of us are practicing, that when you find a place to practice, even if for everyone else it doesn't work, if for you it works, then you stay there until you need some requisites, some medicine or something, or, you know. Is that clear? And if you're at a place that everybody else really likes, but you're not finding yourself doing that inner work, like that inner kind of calm abiding arising in particular, which is the first stage of the work you need to do, don't stay. Because that's really the biggest point in this, isn't it? And if you need medicine or food, and you're trying to do calm abiding, you're not going to do calm abiding, so don't stay. This is a nice rule of thumb, isn't it? There's nothing wrong with trying to find a teacher or a teaching that is right for you. And you don't try to find the right one. You try to see how you respond, given a really good try with somebody. That's clear, isn't it? This isn't, you know, the best 20 monasteries in North America. This is like, what for you actually brings your mind to that point? And I find this sutra very, very applicable in our society. Any questions, answers, comments, or complaints? We might do 3 sutras tonight. No, the next one's quite long. Any other points anyone wants to bring up about this? Thank you. So shall we just jump on to 18? My gosh, in 20 minutes. Watch out, Visuddhi Magga. Majjhimanikaya. Well, this one's fun. Somebody else want to read?
Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the Shakyan country at Kapilavatthu in Nigrodha's park. Then, when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed and, taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Kapilavatthu for alms. When he had wandered for alms in Kapilavatthu and had returned from his alms round, after his meal, he went to the great wood for the day's abiding, and entering the great wood, sat down at the root of a bilwa sapling for the day's abiding. Dandapani, the Shakyan, while walking and wandering for exercise, also went to the great wood, and when he had entered the great wood,
He went to the bilwa sapling where the Blessed One was and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he stood at one side, leaning on his stick, and asked the Blessed One, "What does the recluse assert? What does he proclaim?" "Friend, I assert and proclaim my teaching in such a way that one does not quarrel with anyone in the world with its gods, its Maras, and its Brahmas. In this generation, with its recluses and Brahmins, its princes and its people, in such a way that perceptions no more underlie that Brahmin who abides detached from sensual pleasures, without perplexity, shorn of worry, free from craving for any kind of being."
So now we're into a footnote. I'm already smiling because I like the next verse. But okay, the footnote. Oh yeah, there was a footnote before that. What does he proclaim, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's about Dandapani, whose name means stick in hand, was so called because he used to walk around ostentatiously with a golden walking stick, even though he was still young and healthy. According to goodness, guys, I'm really getting out of touch if I don't know what MA is. Somewhere in the beginning of this book. M.A. Pali term. Nope. Wrong page. Must be at the very beginning, is it? Anybody know? Usually it's really right on the first page. Okay, it's probably on the last page. They always have it somewhere. Anybody know what MA is? You're waiting for my expertise. You know?
No, I'm not going to quickly say.
I'll probably remember, huh? No? I'll probably remember tonight if you want to drop by about 3 in the morning. That's when I usually remember these things. Oh, yeah, it means... Oh, yeah. They usually have it right easy to find. Index of subjects. Glossary. Oh, here we go, maybe. Humph. Okay, can't find it. Looked long enough. Check it out. I'll let you know. Okay. He sided with Devadatta, the Buddha's arch foe. You remember Devadatta from last time we did this? Remember his cousin Devadatta, who became a bhikkhu? Do you remember who sent the raging elephant after him? You've probably heard of that. Who created a schism in the last sutras we did. He created a schism because he became more holy than the Buddha about eating and stuff. One story in Thailand when you talk about Devadatta is that his robes were always carefully folded better than the Buddha's ever were. Because he was like very competitive. He didn't actually want to be a bhikkhu, but his family, when do you remember his family when the Buddha went back to his family after he was the Buddha, he taught there, and everyone was so impressed that they sent all of the relatives to go and study with him. And Devadatta was told that that was going to be his career. He had another thing in mind. So he was like really in the wrong place, and he got very jealous and angry, and that blinded him too. And throughout the Buddha's life, Devadatta continued to plague him.
The MA is on 1159.
1159? What does it mean?
I can't say it. I can't read it.
Oh, okay. 1159, huh? Thanks. Oh, yeah. Right there, 1159. Yeah, Majjhima Nikaya. Oh, yeah, Atthakatha. Atthakatha. It's like sort of... Okay, I'm not going to go there. Anyway, because you know what will happen. I'll talk for half an hour on that, and we're going to do three sutras tonight. So we were talking about the cane wearer, the golden cane guy. Thank you. 226, right?
Yes.
He sided with Devadatta, the Buddha's arch foe, when the latter attempted to create a schism in the Buddha's following, which we read about in the last time we were together on this. His manner of asking the question is arrogant and deliberately provocative. And then he gets even better in the next verse, yeah? Carry on. Oh yeah, no, we have two.
Yeah.
We have the 227, right? The first part of the Buddha's reply directly counters Dandapani's aggressive attitude. In other words, this guy is saying, so what is it you teach that's so great? And he says, we teach there's no enemies. Nice, huh? Because I do not dispute with the world, it is the world that disputes with me. A speaker of the Dharma does not dispute with anyone in the world. The second part may be taken to mean that for the Arahat, spoken of here as the Brahman, as that Brahman, with reference to the Buddha himself, perceptions no longer awaken the dormant underlying tendencies to defilements, which are enumerated further on in this sutra. You know, you've heard me teach that passion, where there's a perception, there will be a passion for most of us. And where there is a passion, there's a perception. If you vote NDP, you have a passion for that, and there are people that are the enemy. Is that true? And to actually let go of that, separate your passions and your perceptions, is something that requires you to see that all beings are awakening. Is that true? So that you would not be upset by this or that. So the first part of what the Buddha says here, I assert and proclaim such a teaching that one does not quarrel with anyone in the world, with its gods, its Maras, and its Brahmas, in this generation with its recluses and Brahmas, its princes and its people. And that's the first part, that's like directly. So what are you so good at teaching? I teach that there is only kindness. Okay, and then the second part, such a teaching that perceptions no more underlie that Brahman who abides detached from sensual pleasures. That if you are detached from your passions are, your perceptions are no longer going to be tainted. If you can see all beings as awakening, your perceptions are no longer going to be tainted. Is that true?
Did you say perception?
Perception is basically three types of perception: being able to see the material world as the material world, the energy world as the energy world, and the mental world as the mental world. that your perception is clearly understanding what is physical, what is speech, and what is mind. And so when something is being talked about in the material world, you understand how the material world comes into being and passes away. You know that nothing arises without cause. So if you wish to, you can perceive the causes for something arising. Because your perception doesn't say, well, that's the right way to act and you shouldn't have voted that way. You can see why somebody voted that way. And you can see the energies. You can see how people are caught in having certain views about how they should be or act, or the passions that we have. And you understand them eventually as just being the four boundless states. That all of the emotional states that we go through are really, you know, just truncated manifestations of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, where we don't feel comfortable with altruism because we want to be safe or defensive or prove that we're as good as someone else or jealous. Or, you understand? So our passions are so often based on self-grasping. But when that is no longer the case, and so therefore are our perceptions, I can choose the good guys. Right? But when that is no longer the case, then you have this beautiful statement here that perceptions no more underlie that Brahman who abides detached from sensual pleasure. So the sensual pleasure is there, but he's detached from it. He can feel preference. He can feel, oh, I prefer ice cream today, thanks. But he isn't caught by it. Like the Buddha saying, there is suffering, but no one suffering. How profound. How simple, how complex, how impossible, how amazing. That's incredible.
Well, basically, it's just that you're not lost, you like your ice cream, but you're not lost liking it, and you're aware that you like it, but it's not totally...
It means that you're not caught in duality.
Yeah. Okay.
So there's nothing to protect. Your likes and dislikes don't define being. Wouldn't that be different? Imagine the range of possibilities in any one moment. But this is just a little sideline. I mean, we've got a whole sutra here. Is that okay for now? So, was that the end of that footnote? Oh, not quite. So, I didn't. Perceptions no longer awaken the dormant underlying tendencies to defilements. Basically self-clinging, self-grasping. Perceptions no longer stir up, when you perceive something, it no longer stirs up the what we would call maybe the shadow or the archetypal, the dormant underlying tendencies to defilements. And the defilements will be enumerated in verse 8. Yeah. Go ahead.
When this was said, Dandapani the Shakyan shook his head, wagged his tongue, and raised his eyebrows until his forehead was puckered in three lines.
There's a footnote. We got to do the footnote. I love that. That's my favorite part. With his gold cane.
Yeah.
This response seems to be an expression of frustration and bewilderment. Okay?
Then he departed, leaning on his stick. Then, when it was evening, the went to Negroda's park, where he sat down on a seat made ready for him and told the bhikkhus what had taken place. Then a certain bhikkhu asked the Blessed One,
"But venerable sir, what is the teaching that the Blessed One asserts, whereby one does not quarrel with anyone in the world, with its gods, its maras, and its brahmins, in this generation with its recluses and brahmins, its princes and its people?" But Buddha, what did you mean by that? "And venerable sir, how is it that perceptions no more underlie that Brahman who abides detached from sensual pleasures?" Did you find it?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Keep going.
Okay. "Without perplexity, shorn of worry, free from craving for any kind of being."
How does this happen?
Bhikkhu, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation...
If you got born there, I got tinged.
Born.
We have different copies. I know I've said
slightly
this before.
Slightly different.
Yeah. Keep going.
"Born of mental proliferation beset a man. If nothing is found there to delight in, welcome and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust."
Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that beautiful? Do you want to read that again?
"Bhikkhu, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust."
Isn't that beautiful?
"Of the underlying tendency to aversion, of the underlying tendency to views, of the underlying tendency to doubt, of the underlying tendency to conceit, of the underlying tendency to desire for being, of the underlying tendency to ignorance. This is the end of resorting to rods and weapons, of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malicious words, and false speech. Here these evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder."
Isn't that beautiful?
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that just beautiful? I know.
A long one.
That is so beautiful. The interpretation of this cryptic passage hinges on the word papancha. Papancha. Or papancha. And the compound papancha, sanya, sankara. Papancha is one of those words that is almost impossible to translate. So let's see what he does with it. Where did you say that was? 1159?
This is like, is he saying if you see things, if you understand that things are empty, then you're no longer attached to them and you're not going to fight over them? And
yeah, but that is one way to do it. Another way is to see how it is because you have this attachment to being separate.
Hmm.
I mean, there's several layers here. Let's go back here. Well, he's going to explain it in the footnote anyway, but let's go back and look at it. "As to the source through which perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation beset a man." Is that good so far? Do you want mental proliferation said more?
Is that naming things?
Yeah, or just thoughts or ideas or views about something.
It's like saying that's ice cream and I like it, and like
or,
it
you know,
when it's a kid.
You know, ice cream is really good for you. It does have calcium in it, in spite of what my doctor tells me. I know because it's made from milk products, and I'm not going to read the label too closely.
Okay.
Yeah. "As to the source through which perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferations beset a man, if nothing is found there to delight in, If I don't delight in holding that view, and my delight blocks for me from seeing that I am holding that view.
It's not delighting. It's not delighting in the actual ice cream. It's delighting in
my
your
view.
Thought. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Welcome and hold to. That's the end of the underlying tendency to lust. But I don't really love to identify myself with that view. It's like, I know it's just a view. So I'm no longer caught by it. So I'm not likely to go to war for ice cream.
But you can still delight in it.
I can still enjoy it, but I don't have to have a view to justify it. And okay, let's see whether the footnote agrees with me. Let's see. You never know. Sometimes I find they do. So, NM. Oh, yeah. Bhikkhu Nyanamoli. Bhikkhu Nyanamoli, that book, The Life of the Buddha, that I've been recommending to you. Do you know that book? The Buddhist Dictionary, Bhikkhu Nyanamoli. Bhikkhu Nyanamoli, beautiful bhikkhu. He spent something like 11 years. In robes, he went through the whole Sutta. He did incredible translation work. He went through the whole of the Sutta Pitaka and picked out everything in it that the Buddha said about his own life, and pulled it out of the Pitaka, and put it in a small book called The Life of the Buddha. And it is an absolutely beautiful book. I mean, if you have never read it, it's really a nice. It's the Buddha telling you about his life according to the Tipitaka. And it really is worth getting. You've been enjoying it, haven't you? How many of anyone other people here got it?
We have
it
home too.
Yeah, it is just really, really worth reading. It's just like really, especially when you find him getting mad or wanting to sleep or something, that makes you feel, oh good, there's hope. Nyanamoli, how about that? Nyanamoli had, this translation is from, translated first by Nyanamoli, and then Bhikkhu Bodhi updated it. So this was one of Nyanamoli's great endeavors. Mm-hmm. He did a lot of translations of the sutras. So beautiful. Mm-hmm. Had translated the former as diversification, and the latter as calculations about perceptions of diversification. Mm-hmm. So papancha. Cecily, stay here. Okay, thank you. I just went tripping off to one of my favorite teachings that I used to chant to myself all the time about papancha, but I'll stay here. It seems, however, that the primary problem to which the term papancha points is not diversification, which may be quite in place when the sensory field itself displays diversity. This is going to sound a little bit complicated, but we'll go through it anyway, and then we'll start picking apart if you want to. So we might not get through to sutras tonight.
So, sorry, which?
Papancha.
Yeah, and what is it been translated to here? Is it?
Well, we haven't got there yet. He's saying that Nyanamoli had translated papancha as diversification. Okay. And the latter as and papancha sanya sankara. Papancha, diversification, leads to sanya and then sankara. Perception and then sankara. What word is he using for sankara? And the latter as calculations, sanya, about perceptions. Sankara, views or, you know, false views.
Mm-hmm.
False views. So false views about perceptions of diversification. So that's how Nyanamoli had translated. Y'all got that? Or you want me to say it again? What?
Again.
Okay. Nyanamoli had translated, the word in the Pali is papancha, which, as I said, is almost impossible to translate. Nyanamoli, one way you could translate it is diversifications, meaning splitting, diverse. There are other meanings too, but that would be particularly what Nyanamoli would, I would think. I don't know, I never met the man. And so he translated papancha as diversification, and then papancha, which leads to perception. Papancha in Pali, the text goes papancha sanya sankara. Papancha is untranslatable, but we're calling it diversifications by Nyanamoli's standard. Sanya is perception. And sankara is false view or wandering blindly. But sankara, more false view in this case. Hard to actually define sankara too. But we'll say false view. Is that good? So he's saying Nyanamoli had translated the former, papancha, as diversification, and the latter, papancha, sanya, sankara, as calculations or views, false views, about perceptions of diversification. Okay? We're all caught up? Any questions, answers, comments, or complaints? You're all okay here? I love this stuff, as you notice. It seems, however, that the primary problem to which the term papancha points is not diversification, which may be quite in place when the sensory field itself displays diversity, when you see subject-object, hear subject-object. It may be that diversification is taking place, but the propensity of the worldling's imagination to erupt, I love his language, in an effusion of mental commentary that obscures the bare data of cognition. So that not that you see something, but you have 1,000 views about what you're seeing, or how it takes you off in 50,000 different directions of, oh God, I forgot to turn the kettle off, maybe I should phone. Oh, there's a store there. Oh, yeah, and then I can get some butter. Right? All from one scene. Maybe out of the corner of your eye, if somebody walked by that way wearing a hat that vaguely reminded you of your kettle. You know? And you're totally unaware of the bare perception, the bare sensory data. Is that true? But the propensity of the worldling's imagination to erupt in an effusion of mental commentary that obscures the bare data of cognition. Isn't that lovely? I like that. You all with me?
Mm-hmm.
All right. In a penetrative study called Concept and Reality in Early Buddhism, which I actually read a long time ago, Bhikkhu Nyananda. Okay, I was putting one more A in there. Banana Anna. Nyananda explains papancha as conceptual proliferation. That's nice. That's, I think, it's more suitable here. And I follow him in substituting proliferation for Nyanamoli's diversification. So that's what most of this footnote is about. That word papancha, which is so, the Buddha is at one time, so far as the sixfold field of sense perception extends, So far extends the world. So far extends the realm of Papancha. When the Papancha of this connected to the sixfold sense impressions is no longer operating, then the world is transformed. Then the world is ceases in a certain way. I'm badly quoting it, but there is this beautiful, there's a lot of teaching if you actually read more of the sutras about Papancha. That is like, I'm sorry there isn't a word in English that really, if you read enough of the teachings, you start to get a feel for it. Like the word dukkha, there isn't exactly a word that catches it, but if you read enough, you start feeling, oh, that's what that's. Bhikkhu Nyananda explains Papancha's conceptual proliferation, and I follow him in substituting proliferation for Nyanamoli's diversification. The commentaries identify the springs of this proliferation as the three factors, craving, conceit, and views. So we're into the Dharmakara. Do you remember the Dharmakara? Ignorance is made up of craving, false view, and conceit. You know what I'm talking about? The Buddha said that if you look at ignorance, it always has three things linked together: craving, false view, and conceit. Okay? So that represents the birthplace of all reality, all manifestation. So it's sometimes referred to as the womb. Sometimes the Buddha calls it the womb of all creation. Craving, false view, and conceit. In the Tibetan tradition, you have these goddesses who are doing the offerings that represent the five senses, right? This one is holding a mirror, this one is holding a lute, right? You remember that? Yes, no, maybe? Mm-hmm. Some of you don't. But there are these different visualizations you get sometimes where you have these goddesses with these symbols of the six sense doors. So the five senses, the sixth sense, the mind, is holding an upside down three-sided pyramid. The three-sided pyramid is called the Dharmakara, and in the Tibetan tradition it represents mind. And what it actually represents is craving, false view, and conceit. Because all that arises is because of mind. It isn't that there isn't arising out there, but my arising of the universe, and yours, certainly my sister's, is different than mine. And a dog and a cat, frogs quite differently, see quite differently, quite happily. They like the rain. It's probably making, you know, the lakes less polluted. They're healthier for a while. True? I'm going grumble, grumble, because my view. Is that true? So the world is dependent on so much conditioning, and so the conditioning of the senses themselves. And how all that data works in the mind, and then the perception based on collecting all this sensory information, and then whatever passion is ruling at the time, what your view is. Sometimes you see a red light and you're glad because then you can find where you dropped your book. Mm. Sometimes a red light and you're really pissed off because you think you're 2 minutes late. Is that true?
Mm. Yes.
Same red light. Mm. Is that true?
Yes.
Mm. But the perception, because of passion, right?
Yeah.
So when you're talking about the Dharmakara, you're talking about craving, false view, and conceit, which is what they're talking about here. It's the basis of the Papancha, ignorance, the birthplace of all manifestation. You know, sometimes you have, you know, these deities in the Tibetan tradition that have these skull cups, you know? And the skull cup has what? Three, what does it says? What does it have about skull cup that has three? With its three segment lines facing you?
Mm.
craving, possibility. The skalka, which is the nectar of all possibility, the water, the nectar of all possibility, sitting there waiting to be born. And when you turn that awareness of craving, false view, and conceit into clarity, emptiness, and non-dual wisdom, then it is the birthplace, the womb of awakening. Same thing, different perception. That's just a little, is that interesting to you?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I find it very interesting. So where were we? The commentaries identify the springs of this proliferation, the springs of this proliferation, as the three factors, craving, sometimes you'll find that factors translated as cankers, that ignorance is based on three cankers which are moving together all the time. Here they have a slightly different era, craving, conceit, and views, on account of which the mind embellishes experience by interpreting it in terms of mine, I, and myself. Beautiful, huh? Papancha is thus closely akin to the manana, conceiving of Majjhima Nikaya, first sutra, which of course you all remember because we did it 4 years ago, was it we started? Oh no, we did the introduction probably 3 years ago. It took us about a year and a half to do the introduction.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. 2.5 years ago. You remember that, don't you?
Like it was yesterday.
Thank you. The compound, papancha sanya sankara, you remember that from earlier in my going blah blah blah? Okay. Is more problematic. Venerable Jnananda interprets it to mean concepts characterized by the mind's prolific tendency. Mm. I really like that sentence. Concepts characterized by the mind's prolific tendency. That's good, isn't it? I write poetry like that sometimes. The mind's prolific tendency. Could you just edit a bit there? But this explanation still leaves the word sanya out of the account. Remember, sanya is perception. Right? Papancha, sanya, perception, sankara. Okay. So who was that, M.A.? Who knows? Oh yeah, the Majjhima Nikaya, Wachami. Anyway. Glosses Sankara by Kotasa, portion, calling it portion, and says that Sanya is either perception associated with Papancha or Papancha itself. So he says it's okay to leave it out because, you know, you don't have to talk about the perception. I go along with Venerable Jnananda in taking sankha to mean concept or notion. Jnani Moli's calculation is too literal rather than portion. My decision to treat sanya sankara as a dvanda, now compound, I'm not going to go there, perceptions and notions. Maybe questions, but he's saying my decision is that sanya sankara should be perceptions and notions. And that's how I would read it too, from my understanding, not from my ability to perceive the depth meaning of Pali. It's from the bits of meditation and the excellent teachers I've had. That's how I would read that. Perceptions and notions, sankara as sanya sankara as perceptions and notions, you know, the proliferation, may be questioned, but as the expression papancha sanya sankara occurs but rarely in the canon and is never verbally analyzed, no rendering is utterly beyond doubt. On alternative interpretations of its components, the expression might have been rendered notions arisen from the proliferation of perceptions. or perceptual notions arisen from proliferation. You have to read it yourself to really get it, but does that give you a good idea? He's trying to figure out how to translate this exactly, and he's giving you as many different ideas and then saying, this is the one I chose. So the one he's choosing is perceptions and notions. The sequel note will make it clear that the process of cognition is itself the source through which perceptions and notions, tinged by mental proliferation, beset a man. The sequel, I'm going to read that again. The sequel will make it clear that the process of cognition is itself, by when you cognize something, it is itself the source through which perceptions and notions, tinged by, when you cognize something, you give a name to something, and immediately with that name, perception, your perception is defined, and notions tinged by mental proliferation beset a man, and all the past experiences you had with that will be tinging, will be coloring it. So to actually see something for the first time is very, very difficult. You can do it if you're doing a lot of mindfulness practice. I told you before about doing a walking meditation on the deck of a freighter once. And I was used to being up there alone. I was sometimes my beloved teacher would put us in retreat on a freighter. It would be one cabin that he'd make everybody double bunk everywhere else and leave one cabin free, and we'd all have to rotate a retreat, or he would decide somebody should do a retreat. And I had the good fortune of doing quite a long retreat on one freighter, and used to walk on the top deck. And there wasn't anybody that came to that top deck mostly, because it was where the chimney used to blow most of the ash. So it was very nice. And I was really had very good concentration on this for some strange reason. I should have stayed on that freighter. Damn. And I was walking around a corner, and there was one of the crew was coming out of a door. For some reason, he was actually up on that deck. And he came out of the door, and there was just a clear cognition without any perception. Just a clear seeing, a clear cognition without any perception or any of the, what does he call them here? Notions tinged by mental proliferation. No attendant ideas about it for 1 second, and then the next second came the rest of it. There was cognition, then there was perception, and then there were the notions. And I could see the process. Boom, boom, boom. It is very useful for you to actually do enough work in meditation. You actually see how your mind is actually working all the time. Then you're less likely to be shocked when you start to lose your mind. Because sometime, maybe only in the last 5 minutes of your life, you're going to lose your mind. Because all of the story of what you're doing has to fold up for you to leave. The tents have to be taken down. The whole grounds closed down. So it's very useful, you know, to actually have developed the ability to watch that process from a state of calm acceptance without being stupid, without losing your ability to cognize, without attachment or aversion, perceive how reality arises and dissolves. Yeah?
That's where they talk about your life passing before you die.
That's part of the process of dying, when you mean, yeah. The folding of the tent.
Yeah, yeah, the folding of the tent and the whole thing.
Yeah, that's part of the tent folding. Oh, there's where my penknife went. I always wondered. If nothing in the process of cognition is found to delight in, if nothing in the process of cognition, in just the process of cognition, if you just perceive cognition, and there is nothing found there to delight in, to grasp, like at that moment, I was just present with cognition, and there was no desire to grasp or not grasp, right? When that guy came around the deck, right? So, to delight in, to welcome, or to hold to, the underlying tendencies of the defilements will come to an end. So you can see them maybe start to arise, but then there's no one there who's interested in them, and they just dissolve. So if you did that big time, you might be able to actually see things as they are.
So that's the judgment.
Yeah, judgment comes from that.
I like it or I don't like
yeah.
it.
Well, like and dislike are related to judgment, but not always are judgment. Sometimes you can make a judgment whether you like or dislike, can't you? You can really like something, but you can judge that, no, I'm not going to do it now. So like and dislike do certainly factor in, but they're considered a slightly different function, mental function, than judgment. Yeah?
Naming
is secondary. Cognition is primary. There's cognition, then there is naming, called perception. Perception is naming. Names are symbols, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
So there is cognition, just bare seeing. And then there is a cognition of that. It is so interesting. When you actually see your mind do it, it is riveting. It is so interesting, my dear.
Well, I guess in the academic world, those two terms would be flipped. Perception would be...
See, cognition has to do with the eye and cognizing. And then perception has to do with the brain.
You see it.
I know, they do flip them.
We have it flipped.
I know,
my
yeah. Quite interesting, indeed.
Well, it makes it a little harder to do this stuff if you forget that.
Yeah. So, that's good? The footnote?
Mm.
You have a question?
When you saw him, when you were cognitizing, were you seeing that it was a him?
No.
So, when you were cognitizing, what did you experience? We're seeing it to him and he has...
I didn't experience anything. I experienced a visual.
With no, it's a him and he has dark curly hair.
No. 1 minute later, then the perception. Who knew? How can you figure that out? But you see, you have to actually have your awareness rather than your thinking about it. It's experiential, it's not thought. It's like, you can. Have you been to the Grand Canyon? We've seen lots of pictures of it, heard people talk about it. So you have a perception of the Grand Canyon, but you have no cognitive, you have not cognized it. You haven't had gone in your eyes seen it. Have you ever been shocked by something?
Mm-hmm.
Where one moment you thought you knew what it was and then suddenly you didn't? And just for a moment there wasn't any naming or anything. There's just space, just time and space opens.
Mm-hmm.
And then 1 second later, oh, that's mm-hmm. a truck coming right at me or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there's just cognition, but there isn't any way to put it in anything. And it's so fast. And the next one is so fast. It's so fast that for most people, you need to be in retreat to see them as two different processes.
Is that why you built cathedrals?
I think this has a lot to do with it. I think the whole space of cathedrals is to bring the mind to a greater spaciousness and rest in the here and now, the way the light is, the way the sound is, you know, the actual space itself affects the whole bodily sensation. I think cathedrals were built to alter consciousness, and they are very successful. I love going to Europe and just going in and out of cathedrals.
I was just going to say, that's like Notre Dame, looking at Notre Dame, and then I'm going, this is really old, this is really cool. But
there was just this cognition, and then this, you know, whatever. And that's close to it, you're close to it, but it's even more subtle than that. And the only time I think one can really have that experience is if one has been doing meditation for a period of time. Where you actually cut out a lot of the things that keep your mind racing, and you have your one-pointed concentration, so that your mind isn't flicking around, because right now, even though you're talking to me, you're also aware of what you're thinking about, and then whether the window's open, and gee, it's a pretty pink sky there, and you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that the mind, but when you have really good focus, good concentration, your mind is only focused on one thing, so you actually see the little moments of change in something. And it's a training, it requires a training to really see these things. Did you go to the weekend with the Fabulous Four that was here? You weren't at the weekend with the Fabulous Four. You know the Fabulous Four?
She was in Europe.
Oh, you were in Europe, right. That was so great. Rob and Karen and Mala and Terry came and did this weekend. And Rob is into physics and astronomy. And Karen is into movement, healing, art, and astronomy. And Mala is into movement and astronomy. And Terry is into meditation and astronomy. So they brought all their telescopes and their slides of the universe. Wasn't that a great weekend? Did it change your mind?
Yes.
Do you walk around under the sky with the same feeling?
No.
Do you find yourself checking to see what planets are up now? Who knew, eh? Suddenly, we are in space, aren't we? It was profoundly beautiful. I really think we should see whether they would come for a week, do the same course, but over a week at River Lodge. Mm-hmm. Or maybe 10 days, do a retreat on it. That was so exciting. That was so profound. So Rob is doing the physics one time, and he's talking about, you know, when sometimes when you see a movie and you see the wheels of a car, but they seem to be turning backward. Have you ever noticed that? Or are you looking at a car and sometimes it looks like the wheel is turning backward by the... Have you seen that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Why does it look like that? Because the car isn't doing that. Why does it look like that?
Mm-hmm.
Because the wheel is turning this way, right? The camera takes a picture only so often. So the first time the wheel takes a picture, the axis is here. On a turn. And so then the axis is here, and then the next time the wheel starts turning, the axis is here when it takes the picture. So the wheel is turning this way, but the picture is taken when the axis is here, right? And so then the next time the camera takes a picture, the axis is here. The wheel is still turning here, but the pictures are taken. So then when you see it as a movie, you see each shot, so it looks like the wheel is going backwards, so you don't see it. The full revolution. Did you get that?
Yeah.
So what you're seeing is just where the camera takes the picture. Did you know your mind does that? That your mind takes a picture and then there's a gap and takes a picture and then there's a gap. Did you know that?
No.
It does. That's how our perception works.
Most of the time the pictures are not being taken.
And there are more time where there is no picture than there is when there's a picture. But we only string together the picture. and make a continuous story. Have you ever watched dreams? Watched your dreams? If you watch your dreams, if you actually have a little bit of awareness in the dream state, it's really a picture and then a gap, and then a picture and then a gap, and then a picture and a gap, and a picture and a gap. As you're waking up, your conscious mind strings the pictures together with a story, and when you wake up, you say, I dreamed I was at a mall and da-da-da-da, but really, there was a picture of a mall with a whole bunch of different things and a gap, and then a picture, whatever the next one was. And but we put the story in between.
Story comes after.
As you're coming out of all the pictures, the meaning. When you're doing Vipassana meditation, one of the exercises that one of my teachers gave me to do that I found very interesting was once you have settled the mind to some degree, we are sort of still talking about the sutra, aren't we? We're talking about perception. Once you settle the mind to some degree, then when thoughts arise, you no longer cut them off. Instead, you follow the thought until it comes to the end. Then you immediately hold that last part of the thought, because there's always a series with the thoughts, right? Mm. It's always a story. You take that last thought, and then you try to go to the one just before it. And then you try to go to the one just before it, and the one just before that. So you go back four beats of your story. And it's very hard to do, because at any point the mind will want to jump off on another one. And you just have to, you teach yourself, like when you're really calm, you can do that. You can go back four. And then what you do when you've gone back four, then you try to go forward the same four. And that's very hard to do. The mind keeps trying to jump off and tell another story. It likes to start on another train in a whole other direction. And you have to go back and forth and back and forth until you can clearly hold, oh yeah, that was the last thought of that sequence. That was the thought that led up to it. That was the thought that led up to that. When you go back and forth, then you start the real part of the exercises. What was the motive? What was the motive that led from this to this? What was the story? And what was the motive that led to this to this? You remember this, don't you? And what was the motive that led from this to this? And what you're actually seeing is you're actually seeing like the little dots of the mind and then your motives. So where there is a perception, then there's a passion. The story is based on the perception and the passion working together. The passion directs the perception, and the perception holds the passion. This is over and over and over in Buddhism. You find this taught. And if you actually observe the mind working, you will see that. And that's why everybody sees things differently. And that's how our minds work. We take certain pictures and then we fill it in. And something doesn't go along with our picture, how come that car's going forward, but the wheels look like it's going backward? Well, we ignore the wheels and we watch the car. Very few people will actually pay attention to the fact that when you see a car in a movie, often the wheels are going backward unless it's retouched. Because you just block it out because it doesn't go with the meaning that you're following. And that's true of a lot of things in our life. What doesn't go along with our meaning, we just ignore. Don't we?
That's why eyewitness testimony is
very
difficult.
Very difficult. You witness testimony is also very difficult. Them witness ooh. Is that okay for now? Does that thoroughly perplex you to the right amount?
No, that's good.
So what you want to do is, like in Buddhism, what you're trying to do is mind the gap, like they say in the subway in England. Mind the gap. They say that in the subway in Toronto too. You know, the gap in the stair. They have that above the doors. I used to ride the subway and just stare at that sign. Mind the gap. I'm trying.
But you have to mind it first, don't you?
Yeah. You have to quit running after the meanings. But we cling to our meanings pretty good, don't we?
I think so.
If somebody finds their life meaningless, that usually means they're going to be taking Prozac soon, doesn't it? You have a question?
Well, I was a little editorializing. I find it interesting in my area of work that meaning doing research, qualitative, what we call qualitative research on what things mean to people, getting into that.
It's very important.
It's a big part of the research that many of my colleagues do.
And look at most of our world. Our culture is run by meaning. I mean, that's what ads are. And most of the meaning is like how we can be cash cows for the marketplace, isn't it? Our work, our life, isn't it?
So
to keep the economy going so that we can keep going.
So
but where? You don't want to look at global warming or stuff like that, yeah?
So the notion is to kind of look at space or the quiet part, and that our whole society is focused on the noise of establishing meaning.
Yeah, and meaning is always in Buddhism. It's basically defined as becoming, because meaning is always what you're aiming for. The meaning of being present is a totally different meaning, isn't it? So that saving, craving, false view, and conceit becomes clarity, emptiness, and non-dual wisdom. Clarity, that you just see that perception is basically clear. The one thing you can say absolutely about perception is like it's a movie screen. Any image can arise. The one thing you can say about all the possible likes and dislikes and hopes and fears is that they're empty of an inherent identity. They can change like nothing. None of them are a fixed identity. One day you will like a red light, the next day you won't. The one thing you can say about yourself when you really look clearly is that you are both clarity and emptiness. So the same state that on the one hand creates the meaning of becoming, on the other hand creates the meaning of non-dual wisdom. We're already here. So to represent that quality of we're already here, in the Tibetan tradition they have these figures that are fucking, my God, don't they have any sense? Like a religious figure, like this man and woman in full sexual embrace. And she's so much smaller than him. Don't they even know about chauvinism? I mean, what's going on with those people? Obviously another culture. But really, representing, and it has nothing to do with male and female in that way, representing your whole state of desire for manifesting to be in a total union bliss with everything that is present. So that just for a moment, all desire is fulfilled and there's nowhere to go. That's what it represents. Total resting, because all meaning is fulfilled in this moment. That's what it represents. What meaning is there then? In total bliss. That's what it represents. Well, you can say other things too, but that's the main focus. Am I going on too far? My God, it's 7 minutes after. Thank you, Bob, for checking your watch. The union will be at me. Okay. We did get through that footnote. Kathy, managed to get reading to number 9. Is that where we are? Number nine. We'll be good from there next month.
Which is half of 18, so it's easy to remember.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
That's meaningful, isn't it?
And the Lord
said, couldn't we just read it, though? That is what the Blessed One said, having said this. The sublime.
one when rose from the seat and went into his dwelling.
Yeah. But no, I didn't want to read that until next month. But that's okay. I'm glad you did.
He went into his dwelling.
Yeah.
And what happened?
Yeah, exactly. This is where the sutra actually starts taking off. This is all of this is just the lead up for that. Then the Buddha goes away. And then everybody is saying, what did he mean?
We don't know what he meant there. Well, let's go ask such and such.
And this whole story about, you know. So I'm not going to ask if you have any questions, answers, comments, or complaints. You'll have to come back tomorrow to tell me that. Because it's like so far over time. You know how the union is with these things. And you notice this very beautiful gold light in your hearts. Just shining away there right about you. You're just next to dinner. Right there in your middle. And it just spreads through your body. Through your shoulders and your hips and down your legs and down your arms, up your head. Please don't close your eyes because my teeth will visit you. Fills this whole room. Whole house, the whole block, the whole city. The whole world. This light just goes out from all of us, just shines out in space through the world. Any circumstance or situation, any being you wish to pray for, just imagine them washed with the light. You think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there's no suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Thank you for your great compassion. Thank you. Thank you.
One and a quarter sutras.